This is Fresh Air. Bernard Cooper's first book, Maps to Anywhere, has just won the Ernest Hemingway Foundation Award, given by the writers' organization PEN. The award is given to an American writer for a first published book of fiction. But Cooper's book is really a collection of essays. The award judges, Peter Cameron, David Levitt, and Carol Masso, said these pieces were part prose poetry, part memoir, part song, which, dictated by Cooper's love of language, his reverence for memory, and the quirky shapes experience takes, expand the notion of what fiction can be. We wanted to meet the writer the judges were so enthusiastic about, so we invited Cooper to talk with us and to read from his book. Here's the opening of his piece, The House of the Future.
I was 12 when I saw The House of the Future. It was past the gate to Tomorrowland, commissioned by Walt Disney and molded from Monsanto plastic. Composed of four modular wings cantilevered from a pedestal, all the walls gently curved. The entire structure appeared to hover, weightless and white, more of a craft than a habitat. Shaded by its massive shadow, my parents and I waited in line, impatient for our tour through. Mother was dressed in her Mondrian muumuu, a few big blocks of primary color. Father in his Hawaiian shirt, a snarl of palm fronds and stalks of bamboo. I wore mouse ears and madras shorts. "Can you imagine?" Mother exclaimed, craning her neck. Father nudged me. Suppose this was home. Hour after hour of my life had been spent in just such supposition. I was a boy obsessed with the future, searching through my comic books for tomorrow's uncanny manifestations. Cars humming above the earth, equipped with anti-gravity engines. Supermarkets stocked with hydroponic produce. String beans hefty as baseball bats. Pea pods huge as canoes. Cryogenics commonplace. The dead suspended in beds of ice, to thrive again when science permits. Time was a road that led to utopia, or so I believed. And life, prolonged, would be nearly perfect. Humankind molded like plastic till virtue and peace and pleasure prevailed. On the pages of my comic books, all the astonishment promised by the future was evident in architecture. Amphitheaters beneath glass domes, arcades on the tiers of ziggurats, conical towers piercing the clouds and bridged by walkways and tubes. Efficient, ideal, inevitable, the buildings of the future would look like machines.
How much did you buy into that idea of the future when you were young? Did you really believe in it?
I really did. I mean, I did go to Disneyland as a child, and I had a kind of precocious interest in architecture from the time I was about 11 or 12 years old. I was fascinated by Frank Lloyd Wright, by Mies van der Rohe. And, you know, like most kids who grew up in the mid to late 50s, there was the sense that America was on this endless road toward progress, that eventually all disease would be conquered, that there was sort of this limitless and bright future. And I have to admit, I believed it for a while, although I think I was always aware that there was sort of a dark underpinning to all this, that there was something a little bit malevolent about the possibilities in the world as well. And I think I was always aware of that conflict too, but I wanted to believe that everything would be sort of perfect and shiny and wonderful when I grew up.
Well, your heart was in the home of the future, but you lived in your parents' house. What was the house like?
Well, the house was actually a very typically Southern California house. It was a Mediterranean house, very thick walls, cool during the summer, arches, dark wood, Spanish tile. So it really bore no resemblance to the kind of houses that were at Disneyland or in the comic books that I talk about in this piece. And, of course, apart from the architecture at home, the home life there was very different as well. My brother was ill when I was very young. My parents had their domestic problems, and there was definitely a discrepancy between the way life was and the way life was supposed to be.
Now, your piece that you read from The House of the Future isn't just about your interest in Walt Disney-style futurism. It's also about your brother who was dying of leukemia when you were growing up.
Right.
And can you talk a little bit about why you wanted to to put both of those ideas together in one piece, what the connection is.
In retrospect, at any rate, I think that I realized that those ideas were together during the period when my brother was dying. I suddenly realized one day that I did have this obsession with utopian architecture simultaneous to the demise of my brother. And as soon as I thought that and realized the discrepancy between those two things, the sort of willful wish to have a perfect, pristine, clean future, and then the, of course, sorrow of what was happening in the house, it seemed sort of stunning and amazing to me, and something that I wanted and I think in some ways needed to explore in my work.
How old were you when your brother was sick?
I was about 12 years old.
What were your responsibilities to him? And were you the older brother or the younger brother?
I was the younger brother. Actually, I'm the youngest of three. And I don't think I had any responsibilities in regard to him in terms of taking care of him, but I think I enjoyed the notion that I might be able to entertain him. There was something sort of appealing about the idea that he was home and he was always there for me, and there was a kind of intimacy. Ironically, because of the fact that he was bedridden, and yet, of course, it was a horrendous thing to witness at the same time.
Well, let me have you read an excerpt of the part in that piece that's about your brother dying.
All right.
And this is about when he's really getting close to death and what your reaction is right to his bodily changes.
In the weeks that followed, Dr. Wirtz doubled the dosage of Gary's medication. My parents took turns walking him several times a night, plying him with pills. As a result of one diuretic, my brother was constantly dehydrated. His skin bloomed with scales he scratched and shed. I was seized with panic at the sight of his face and arms. The sour smell of his body was unbearable. I began to believe, with a new and superstitious conviction, that my brother had become contagious, that remnants of his skin were everywhere, hidden in the carpet or floating on the air, ready to infect me. I kept my door closed. I held my breath in the hall. I would not walk barefoot. I adopted my mother's concern for cleanliness, wiped the doorknobs with disinfectant, ran hot water over forks and spoons. I refused to enter my brother's room, refused to smile with my parents and talk of swimming and college and marriage, even after Martin urged me to be kind. Martin was my brother's nurse at the time.
Did you confess these thoughts to anybody?
Not at the time, no. In fact, I think one of the reasons why I was compelled to write about this was there was a tremendous amount of silence about this while it was happening. My parents, understandably, I suppose, in some way, really tried to maintain a positive attitude, although it wasn't working. And oddly enough, it was not discussed much, partly, I think, to maintain a kind of perhaps false hope, and also because it was just too painful, I think, for any of us to confront outright. It was very difficult for that reason.
Were you upset that you were allowing yourself to be overcome by these fears of contagion? Were you criticizing yourself for that at the time?
Absolutely. I was really drawn toward my brother to be with him, to spend time with him, perhaps even some sense to save him in a way. And yet I was subject to these feelings of, well, revulsion, really. And it was very difficult, very, very much a conflicting feeling.
Do you think that your brother's death made you any more scared or any more adventurous in how you approached your own life?
I think probably both. I think that it was, suffice to say, a very frightening and affecting experience. But I think that one way in which it affected me is that it made me very aware of the elegiac nature of art. And I think that's an element that runs throughout all my work. I would like to think that if life is short, then at least there's a possibility that art can somehow fix experience, that it's an elegiac procedure in some way. And that's one of the reasons for my fierce attachment to art, is trying to fix things, to make things matter, to make things permanent, I think, in some way.
My guest is Bernard Cooper. His book, Maps to Anywhere, just won the Ernest Hemingway Foundation Award given by the writers' organization PEN. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Bernard Cooper is my guest. You're talking about, like, fixing something in memory, and I guess also trying to, like, make things matter. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
To give them the weight that they have when they're fixed in time through art.
Right.
But I wonder what you feel your responsibility is to, in dealing with memory, to the truth as it was lived,
mm-hmm.
versus manipulating the actual truth a little bit to maybe come up with a larger truth that will have more literary meaning, even if it's not completely true to the reality of what happened.
Right. Well, that's an issue that absolutely fascinates me. One of my favorite writers is the writer Bruno Schultz. And something he said, which I found so moving, was that memory is the fixed fund of capital which a writer draws from for the rest of their lives. And I've always found that to be the case. And I take a lot of liberties with my work, I have to admit. And memory is a very fragile, very tenuous thing. And often in the process of writing, I realize that there are lapses in memory or spaces. And I really am very willing to fill them in with fictive elements or to just do the best I can in terms of remembering them. And I think that it has the effect that you mentioned, that it seems sometimes closer to the truth, that a little bit of exaggeration or distortion for the sake of art can actually give a greater sense of veracity or impact to a work of art, even if it's not absolutely true.
You have one piece that's called Childless, and you write that you're childless and intend to stay that way.
Right.
And if you're willing to talk about it, I'd be interested in hearing why.
Well, the reason is that I'm gay, and it's funny, there's a kind of prejudice, I think, or astonishment on the part of some people when you mention that you not only really don't want to have children, but don't really feel regretful about it. I don't dislike children in any way, but it's something that I've resigned myself to and am perfectly happy about, and something that I wanted to write about as well. There was something about the notion that I was the end of the line, in a sense, and that seemed kind of compelling and moving, a little frightening to me, and I wanted to deal with it.
That notion of being the end of the line, is that a self-imposed notion, or is that something that came from your parents?
Well, I think it's a self-imposed notion. I'm the last remaining sibling alive at this point, and I'm gay, and I'm not going to have children, and, you know, there's something pretty amazing about that, and I wanted again to address that somehow in my work.
You said you're the last remaining sibling?
Right. I had three brothers, all of whom have passed away over the last about 15 years.
What's happened to them?
Well, one of leukemia, one of cancer, and one of a heart attack.
Wow.
Yeah. Very scary.
Must make you feel awfully vulnerable.
It does. It was also very strange because my last remaining brother, Ron, who was about 58 years old, died when I was in the middle of this book, this novel about a young boy's relationship with his brother. And it was so sort of disturbing to me to have that happen in the middle of this book that I actually stopped writing for a number of months, trying to sort of digest it all. And it was a very difficult period.
Do you feel comfortable writing about your brother's death? About any of your brothers.
Oh, yeah.
and their deaths.
Well, no, actually, but, boy, this is a sort of odd thing to say, but I don't feel comfortable writing about it, but it's precisely the discomfort that compels me to write about it. I think that usually something that drives me to work is when an idea is a little bit disturbing or uncomfortable or odd, inexplicable in some way that necessitates my writing about it. And I think I've got a lot more to write about my family and all the things that have transpired since I was a kid.
I guess if something makes you uncomfortable, then you know you're really getting to something.
I think so. I think that's true. And there's a way in which things can come too easily and be a little bit too funny or flip. And those things are usually the things that I end up throwing away. And those tones are usually the tones that don't last very long in any given piece. They often turn a little bit darker eventually. So, you know, and I like that kind of edgy sense of working with material that's a little difficult and a little disturbing.
Well, Bernard Cooper, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It was a great pleasure.
And congratulations again on the award.
Thank you very much.
Bernard Cooper's book, Maps to Anywhere, is published by the University of Georgia Press. It just received the Ernest Hemingway Foundation Award from the writers' organization, PEN. This is Fresh Air.